I think we'll come to order here, and everybody's being real quiet, so we might as well get started. So fire things up, then. We do have a quorum. So we've got a number of bills here today. Let's start with the minutes of February 27. Everybody's read them, I'm sure, so somebody want to move the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes.
Thank you, Representative. Moves the minutes of February 27 for approval. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Minutes are approved. So we've got House File 1713. Representative Morrison. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr.
Explain
Chair.
Explain your bill, if you would.
I will.
Let me look here what we're doing. Okay. I'm going to move House File 1713 to be referred to the General Register, Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed.
House File 1713 is a DNR-recommended bill that I believe Representative Fabian carried last time. Thank you for that. It modifies statutory language as it pertains to the exemption of taking threatened or endangered species from ditches and roadways as part of road projects. Refining existing language will provide a consistent understanding of the threatened and endangered species law and exemptions that apply. This clarification will make it easier for road authorities to understand their responsibilities under the Protection of Threatened and Endangered Species Law. And I do have a testifier with me.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chairman, committee members, I'm Ann Pierce. I'm Deputy Director of Ecological and Water Resources with the Department of Natural Resources. And first of all, I wanted to thank Representative for carrying this bill. We appreciate that. And as she said, it is to clarify language in statute. It's a relatively simple change from the word roadways, which has multiple definitions, to right-of-way, which has a standard definition within statutes so that everybody has the same understanding of what is meant by the law. Over the past 2 years, we've been working with the county road engineers, and I think we have a testifier from Pope County with the county engineers to work on language so that we agreed on having clarified language so that everybody understood what the law was pertaining to and where the exemption was within the law. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Question coming up here, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify to the testifier, you are in agreement with the with this bill language to the DNR testifier?
We are in agreement with, yeah.
Okay. Seeing no further questions at this time, there's another testifier, Representative Morrison.
Yes, Mr. Chair, there is.
Good morning. Welcome, and introduce yourself for the record and proceed, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Brian Geese. I'm the Pope County Engineer and Secretary for Minnesota County Engineers Association. So today I'm testifying on behalf of the Minnesota County Engineers Association. As previously stated, since January 2017, the County Engineers Association has been meeting with MnDOT and the DNR regarding interpretation of this Minnesota Statute 84.0895. which has to do with the protection of threatened and endangered species. At that time, it was brought to our attention the DNR had been requiring permitting and mitigation fees for certain highway and bridge work in existing right-of-way, and we had a discrepancy in interpretation over the existing language that specifically exempted ditches and roadways, and so we feel that this compromise language reached together will adequately provide that exemption for existing highway right-of-ways.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Lute?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess one of the things that we've got a new definition here, or hopefully a better way to define stuff, but one of the areas that I guess I'd like to know a little more about is how do we define disturbed by construction or maintenance? For example, simply removing the vegetation, trees along the right-of-way, does that fit the definition of construction or maintenance? Because that's a kind of cyclical thing. Sometimes road authorities allow that area to grow up to a certain point, and then it becomes a vision hazard or whatever, and then they'll go ahead and remove it. So I think that's where some of the friction has been. If you've done that once, is that regardless of what has happened in the succeeding 20 years, does that qualify as maintenance for the right-of-way? So you wouldn't be have to worry about what decided to grow up after you performed that initial maintenance.
Yes, whoever wants to respond here.
I would ask first from the county engineer's perspective, okay. When you go out and take timber and trees and brush off, do you consider that maintenance, or is that your definition of maintenance, or what would fit into that tool?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the county engineer's definition of maintenance would be any work that involved improving or enhancing the safety and transportation around the existing roadway. That may include things as little as mowing, but more clearly, when dirt has been moved or excavated to form a ditch from the native ground. I defer to the DNR for their response.
Mr. Chair, if we could get the DNR to kind of compare if that's their definition also, and particularly when we're talking about mowing or removing a vegetation. Obviously, it's pretty easy if we did a backslope or something like that.
Ms. Pierce.
Thank you, Chairman and Committee. Yes, that what you defined would be standard maintenance. So that kind of mowing and periodic tree removal, that would be standard maintenance. That would not fall under the language that is in there.
That's a big step forward, because particularly in some of the roads, they get quite a bit of vegetation growing up, and then somebody comes along and says, well, there might be an endangered species in there, even though it may have been clear ground 15, 20 years before, and away we go. 2 years later, we're still trying to clean up the right-of-way, and so hopefully this will end any of those potential conflicts, because, like I say, the main goal here is public safety and highway safety, to make sure that we don't encumber line of sight and drainage and those types of things.
Thank you. Representative Luke, we can only hope that spotted gnat doesn't become an endangered species.
There you go. Is that, Mr. Chair, does that include willow brush and buck brush and alder brush too?
Someday. Any further questions for the testifiers or Representative Morrison? If not, I don't see any. Any testifiers from the audience on this bill? Seeing none, some closing comments, Representative Morrison.
The House File 1713 is a very straightforward bill, just clarifying language. I would ask for your support. Thanks for hearing the bill.
Okay, so I'll renew my motion that House File 1713 be moved to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you for this bill, and going to the floor. So.
Thank you. Want to join me?
Representative Morrison, we're going to have House File 1885 in front of us here, and let me look. Where's the? Okay, so House File. I'll move that House File 1885 be referred to Ways and Means. Representative Morrison, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1885 will increase the surcharge on watercraft licenses from $5 to $20 over 3 years, to be paid over 3 years. This fee will provide more funding for the Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center, which is critical to doing long-term research, and will also help lake associations who pay for the management of much of AIS so that lakes can remain usable by the public. I do have a testifier with me today.
Very good. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Forster, and I represent Minnesota Lakes and Rivers Advocates, and we would be in support of this bill. A little background. The AIS surcharge on watercraft hasn't been increased since it was put in place back in the 1980s. I think 1989 was the year. There was a couple dozen lakes that were infested with AIS at that point. Now we're close to 700. So just from that standpoint, it seems like it's time to catch up. Lake associations often bear the costs for managing aquatic invasive species, so treating the lakes to reduce the spread. For instance, Lake Coronis is spending $70,000 a year to treat starry stonewort at the public access, which reduces the risk of it being spread to other lakes because the concentration is lower in, you know, at boat ramps. Some lakes are spending, you know, over $100,000 a year on this. The DNR at one time had a grant program similar to what's described in this bill that helped defray some of those costs. And as their workload has increased, they had to cut that back a few years ago. And this also, I think, supports the effort to create more of a comprehensive program. So if we look at AIS, we need the DNR doing inspections. The counties have a role to play with their local resource managers. Restoring budget to the DNR through the surcharge would help them with training and outreach and coordination between the counties and what the counties are doing. Obviously, research is one of our best opportunities, but it's hard to do long-term research when you don't have a reliable source of funding to do long-term query. And then lake associations have a role to play because they're the ones that are on the ground. So if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to do my best to answer them, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess this is really for the bill author. Have we explored any other funding streams? We've got a lot of dedicated funds that we do through lottery, through sales tax that are directly supposed to benefit the habitat. Since the invasive species things is a constantly dynamic, changing thing, I would hope we don't consider those dedicated funds as can't be used because that's a level of effort within the DNR because there's something new pops up every year. So I guess what types of other ways have we looked at to fund this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lewick, I think that the thought is that since this fee has not been raised since 1989 and it already is a pretty low fee and it applies directly in that the votes that quite frankly, spread aquatic invasive species, it seems like a logical place to increase the fees very slightly, really.
Ms. Chair, a little bit of follow-up in there. So there are a lot of smaller watercraft that I guess, I think of boats. Yeah, there's a $50,000 boat on a $20,000 trailer behind an $80,000 pickup. But what about the smaller watercraft that have to be licensed that may not ever leave the lake? Is there any exception or way to deal with that, or is this just going to get one size fits all?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lewick. You know, the $20 fee is a starting point. I think that this will probably get sorted out, hopefully, in the finance division once we get there, assuming we do, from Ways and Means. Your point is well taken. There are different kinds of boats.
Mr. Chair, I would ask for a roll call vote on this item. Thank you.
So noted. Other Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier or the bill author, part of the money for this fee is going to go to local lake associations. I like that, but sometimes they have a difficult time coming up with a match. Will this require a match from lake associations to qualify for this grant as well?
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am not certain. I believe as it's written, it would not.
Can we
check with...
Okay, go ahead.
But perhaps we can get a reading on it from someone who's better able to read this language.
Okay, we'll ask please report. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, the language right now does not specify that a match would be required, whether or not the DNR implemented one would get to them.
Well, thanks again, Mr. Chair, but as I recall, some of the earlier grant money going to counties did require a match. So is this going to be confusing? Is it going to be two separate pots of money going to counties and lake associations, one requiring a match and one not requiring a match? That's just a question that I'd pose to the bill author as this bill moves along to clarify that situation.
Any comments, Representative Morrison?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a good point. Okay. We'll have to clarify that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I'm reading the bill here, I'm not seeing it, but maybe I've missed it. To the bill author, Representative Morrison, is there any kind of exemption for my nonprofit organizations, my camps? We've talked about that in previous committees. This is absolutely a massive issue in my district with dozens and dozens of camps and thousands of canoes and all sorts of other kinds of watercraft. Am I missing it, or what's the purpose, or where is it here or not?
Representative Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Heinzman, I don't believe that it is in this version, but again, this is a starting point, and that's certainly something that we can talk about and consider.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, it would be, I think, a really wise move to consider exempting them. We're talking about kids literally that wouldn't go to camp because of something like this, and it wouldn't just be a couple. We're talking about probably hundreds of kids, and we're talking about a lot of donated money to even make that possible for them, and putting something like this together on organizations that literally never move their boats. Their equipment stays in the lake and will never leave until it's probably no good. I hope you take that very seriously.
Representative Heinzman, there could be in this process education for these youngsters about AIS in lieu of a stamp, something like that. We should be educating those youngsters. So,
yes, sir. Wouldn't disagree, Mr. Chair. I'm always nervous when we have some kind of a mandate from the state of Minnesota.
Understood. Representative Beckerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I did just want to point out, as we talk about the cost, it's a three-year license. So we're still only looking at $6.67 per year. I only own a canoe, and I don't have any trouble paying that. I understand there may be members who own 13 boats, but even if you owned 13 boats, you're still only looking at $86.71 for all of those boats total. So I think it's a very small amount to pay for something that's absolutely very important. So I thank you for bringing this forward, and I think to the previous comments, I think, you know, looking at ways that we're not negatively impacting a nonprofit camp, we can easily, you know, amend it to make it make sense for that. But I will say there are also camps that compete in regattas and, you know, sailing competitions and all kinds of other events where they are transporting boats from lake to lake. So I would just want to point that out as well, but do thank you for bringing it forward. It's a good bill. Thank you.
You have, Representative Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Is there a companion bill for this in the Senate?
Representative Morrison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bull, we are looking for a Senate author.
Very good. Other Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morrison, in subdivision 4 on page 2, line 2.8, when we're talking about the account, what about just using the LCCMR dollars for that instead of, if all Minnesotans benefit from aquatic invasive species research and so forth, why wouldn't we, why are we just targeting watercraft owners?
Representative Morrison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I believe part of the idea is to increase the amount of available resources to study aquatic invasive species.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you can do that with the LCCMR money going to the Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center. That's my point. And then can you walk me through exactly what is the process that's used at DNR for a lake association to apply for a grant?
Representative Morrison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I would defer to my testifier for that question if you're able to help me with that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, maybe Bob Meyer can describe it in detail. I've never applied for a grant, but as I understand it, they would open the granting process and it was a first-come, first-served basis. Lake associations would apply through the DNR and then receive the money in time to do the treatments over the summer.
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members of record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner DNR. I have with me Ann Pierce, our Deputy Director of Ecological Water Resources as well. Just to clear up a couple things, we do require a match for our grant program. In the past, this grant program has been eliminated because of the need to provide resources to ensure the county dollars. So that, just so people know, there's $10 million of local government aid that goes through the tax committee that's distributed to counties based upon the number of water access sites they have and the number of parking spots they have for AIS-related activities. So they do inspections, they do education, they fund staff, things like that. We reduced our grant program several years ago to make sure that we had the resources available to provide the assistance counties need. We have to train over 1,000, there's over 1,000 county-funded inspectors that are inspecting watercraft as well. We need to make sure that they're educated, they're certified, they're doing this in a way to not create a problem at the boat landing, so to speak. Some of these times, sometimes things at boat landings could get kind of heated if we don't manage them the right way. So there's all those assistance activities that we decided we needed to spend money on from our existing dollars rather than the grant program. This bill would reinstate funding for that grant program, as would the DNR's AIS surcharge increase within the governor's budget. But there would be a lot less activities under the governor's budget initiatives. So with that backdrop, I'm going to let Ann Pierce talk about how we do our grant program and what that looks like.
Please introduce yourself.
I'm Ann Pierce, Deputy Director of Ecological and Water Resources with the DNR. Chairman, committee members, we, at this point, when we last did our grant program, what we try to do is to distribute the money evenly out to the people who are applying it. So at one time, we had quite a bit of grant money, around $900,000. We were able to give each applicator a fairly good share of their cost. And so their share was maybe around 50%. Ours was around 50%. As we lost that money, we still wanted to distribute it so that people who needed it could get it, but their share of the cost then went up because of that. So the way we try to do it is, especially those first set of grants that come in the spring, pretty much everyone gets a grant. It's just as our money was reduced, it got to be a smaller amount.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Pierce, does the agency charge an administrative fee against the grant application? So if there's $900,000 in the account, how much actually gets out the door? Does the DNR withhold some for administrative costs?
Chairman, committee members, no. Not, if there's $900,000 for grants, $900,000 goes out. Sometimes, however, just to if you apply for a grant and for whatever reason you can't get that treatment done, then that grant money still is sitting there, right? So if a lake association applied for a grant and it came to July and the weather conditions weren't right or whatever that might be, they may have remaining grant money. That money would come back to us, and then we'd redistribute it again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just a general comment. A couple, few weeks ago, several of the resort owners were visiting me in my office, and they're talking about how they're watching every dime and so forth in their business operation. It's becoming more and more important and more difficult for what I would call the mom-and-pop resorts to make ends meet, and I'm concerned about this on them. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I just might briefly address a question that the committee had regarding boats that don't leave lakes. Even if you have a boat that sits on a boat lift, that doesn't mean that you're not a possible vector for bringing AIS into that water body. What we see is people who have lakeshore that have docks and have water lifts, some of those people buying new equipment or moving equipment, even though there's a 21-day decontamination period, so if you're buying a new dock or boat lift, you have to keep your old system out of the water, like on your front lawn or someplace, for 21 days before you can sell it. We've seen that the substantial infestations have occurred because of people bringing in a used boat lift from one boat water body or another. For example, if somebody were to sell, and this is a case I dealt with last year, a person on Lake Minnetonka, zebra mussels, other issues infested, wanted to sell their boat lift to somebody up north. They said, what do I do? And I said, hold on, you have to wait 21 days, things like that. The movement of these water-related equipment that we talk about is something that we're very concerned about as well. I know Otter Tail County is talking about registering docks so they can track where dock movements are going. So just because you may have a boat and you keep it on your lake year-round doesn't mean there's not a potential for you to bring in some vector that would cause that water to become infested.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify, with this new reinstated DNR program, we're looking at a 50% match to lake associations. Is that correct?
So basically depends on how much money that surcharge will generate for the grant. So how many boats of those $2 that go to the grants, how much would that add up to? And so it's probably going to be somewhere between $400,000 and $700,000 or something like that. And so depending on where it lies, the more it is, the more we can match. But there's a certain cost per acre for treatment that, you know, the herbicide costs and all that. So what we will still try to do is distribute that evenly, and the person applying for it then would have to pay the rest of the cost of the treatment. And it'll depend on how much we get, how much is brought in from that surcharge. So if you have 600,000 boats compared to 800,000 boats, you're going to have potentially $400,000 coming in from the 600,000 boats and potentially 900,000 coming in from the 8,000 boats. So then you would have a different pot of money to deal with.
Mr. Chairman, just really quickly on that. We'll work with the author and the stakeholders and Representative Anderson, if you wish to be involved in that conversation, on what parameters should be put around this, what should the match be. I think it's important to have some level of match. But, again, that level of match will provide for how much grants we can provide out there as well. So we'll be looking for legislative input and guidance on that. And Ms. Pierce is absolutely right. This whole thing and the author, it's scalable. How much do we want to do? How much prevention? How many grants do we want to do? What should the surcharge look like, and who should be paying for it? So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm realizing that I should probably add a little bit of background. I made a comment specifically about transporting boats, and I'm not sure, maybe the commissioner and I think maybe Representative Becker Finn also mentioned something. Haven't been privy to some of the conversations. I have lots of lake associations in my district, and there's an ongoing conversation about boats being transported from other places all over the state of Minnesota to lakes in my district. And we're troubleshooting, trying to figure out how do we avoid that contamination coming from other places. And there's those that would like to do some pretty drastic things like close accesses, which obviously that's a problem. And then there's others that have talked about possibly incentivizing people to keep boats in one location as opposed to transporting them. And we may incentivize them by lowering some fees or other things. Those are just ideas that lake associations are talking about. You may not know about that, but that is a part of the conversation. And by raising fees on boats that are literally bought brand new, put in a body of water in front of a camp, oftentimes a camp that's funded through donations, and it never leaves that body of water, there may be something there that we need to look at, try to incentivize them. Or in this particular case, I would probably be looking to completely exempt my nonprofit camps.
Mr. Chairman, on that note, if you want to upset the resorting community, tell the resorts that their customers can't bring their own boat into their resort. I've had conversations with them before, and obviously if we want to prohibit the movement of boats, it's one thing, but I know, you know, there's a lot of people who invest a lot of money in their boats, and they want to take them up to Lake X, Y, or Z to go fishing, so it's just something we need to be careful if we're looking at that.
Representative Heineman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Commissioner. And that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is there a way to incentivize people to, when they come to a lake, to maybe rent a boat as opposed to bring one? That is a conversation that's happening at inside lake associations. That's not something I'm telling the DNR that needs to be done. That's not something that I think is even really a bigger part of the conversation, because it was brought up by yourself and Representative Becker Finn. We're having that conversation right now, and that's why there needs to be a clarification. This is something that lake associations are talking about as they're troubleshooting, how do we stop aquatic invasive species?
Very good. Representative Blue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this is primarily for the DNR. At least the counties I'm familiar with in my district both have got very aggressive local programs funded through that process you talked about, where we get the local, to get the money down to the local level. They've invested in a huge amount of equipment using a variety of county resources plus volunteer resources. So this grant program, if it did go back into effect, how would the DNR look? Would they look down at the local level, for example, see exactly what Crow Wing County or Aiken County is doing relative to working with lake associations before they kind of went in on top and said, oh, we're gonna do this? It would seem like we're setting ourselves up here for potentially a conflict. It would make me, it might make sense to let you know, one person ride the horse as opposed to sticking two or three on the back and maybe confusing the horse.
We'll get the horse up there. Ms. Pierce.
Thank you, Chairman. Committee members, yeah, so we are working with a lot of the counties, and the counties are investing differently, but most of them are investing in the prevention side of things, which is the inspectors. And, you know, we would be happy to continue to work, like Commissioner Meyer said, we'd be happy to continue to work with people to see how this kind of money would be distributed and what those qualifications would be and how we determine how to distribute it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yeah, the important thing is, excuse me, it costs money to get to get money down there to manage a grant. And so we've got some counties that are doing essentially that in a variety of ways. And so rather than run dual approaches, it would seem like it might be a little more efficient to stick with one way, get more money down there. That's my thoughts, at least looking at the what I hear from the Lakeshore Associations, the resorters in my area, plus the county, is that we've really over time built a really solid, aggressive approach. And like you say, right now, that approach is really focused on prevention. But as I drive around in my district, I see equipment sitting there and people literally at all kinds of accesses on a daily basis. So I've just got some great reservations here that we need more funds. That's always a problem, but I just see that this is a, maybe we should send those funds directly to the county as opposed to reinstating a program or boning up a program that's kind of run from St. Paul down here as opposed to at the local level.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Mayor.
Just really briefly on that, I know we have other bills in the committee. We have regional aquatic invasive species specialists in all four regions of our state that work very closely with the counties and their districts. So there is, it's to take some words from Mr. Forrester, as we were talking earlier, it's a three-legged stool. It's research, it's prevention, and it's inspection. And we're making sure that we're working very coordinatedly, hand-in-hand with the counties throughout the state, understanding what their needs are, trying to work with them on how to increase or support their activities that are there, but also work with the lake associations and fund these grant activities that they would like to see reinstated. So we're working very closely to ensure that those dollars are spent as best as possible, and we get the biggest bang for the buck, and this would just help us be able to do that.
Representative Makem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And testifiers, I think we've heard several comments about people who would be potentially impacted by this, whether it's resort owners or camps or people who live on lakes, and I think one thing they all have in common is that they really want a healthy lake. And so because we're seeing that it's water-related recreations that are causing the transfer from lake to lake, I think it's imperative that especially the users of the lake, whether they are residential and only on that lake, they want their lake to be healthy. I think it's important that we all play a piece in ensuring that going forward. And so I appreciate the bill being brought up, and I appreciate the attention being put to it. I had a quick question. I know that there are licenses for canoes, and we have other kinds of watercraft, especially now today, like the paddle boards that go from lake to lake. Are they ever seen as an issue or something? I know that I don't think they're licensed, maybe just registered, and just wondering how that's looked at.
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chair, representatives, they are registered, depending if they're over 10 feet, I believe is the number. They do require a registration fee. They certainly can be a vector. Anything that can contain water, you know, they have a little handle spout. Some of them have cup holders or whatever. If they aren't drained completely and washed and taken care of, just like any other water-related equipment that we have, the trampolines, right? If you leave a trampoline in there, the anchor rope could get contaminated, things like that. So it's important to realize anything that you have in the water could be a possible vector. We're working with duck hunters, for example, as they're pulling off their decoys in the muck, making sure that their duck boats are clean and their decoys are decontaminated, you know, things like that. So every place we can work to educate people, we're trying to do so right now.
Thank you.
Representative Bolt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to the grants to the lake associations, can the smaller lake associations utilize in-kind grants with volunteer time and things, or does it have to be a dollar for dollar?
Chairman, committee members, they can use that. Typically what they're using for invasive aquatic plants, you need a permit. So coming to us with the grant program is kind of a one-stop shop. It makes it easy for the applicant to apply for the grant and get the permit at the same time. Typically, the grant is helping pay for the actual herbicide that they're using.
Very good. I don't know if I made the call to the audience if anybody wants to testify for or against the bill. Seeing no further questions or testifiers, I'll renew my motion that I gotta look back here now. Do you remember? You can do it too.
House File 1885.
Yeah, be referred to Ways and Means. And roll call has been requested. So the clerk will take the roll. Chair votes aye.
Becker Finn?
Yes.
Lewick?
No.
Akam?
Yes.
Anderson?
No.
Bow?
Yes.
Claflin? Fabian?
No.
Gomez?
Yes.
Green?
No.
Hansen?
Yes.
Heinzman?
No.
Lippert?
Yes.
Wiginius?
Yes.
Our tally is 9 in favor and 5 opposed, so 1885 is on its way to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Marson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And just of note, I had the time of the committee wrong, so I brought cookies thinking we were in the afternoon. So if you'd like a morning cookie, please help yourself.
Okay, we are ready to proceed, and the agenda list House File 569, an Eklund bill, and that bill is being added to 1586, House File 1586, the Becker Finn bill that we're about to hear.
Mr. Chair, I would move House File 1586. And you'll have to remind me where you would like this to go next.
And let's... Okay, so House File 1586 is recommend pass and go to Ways and Means, refer to Ways and Means. So it is in front of us, and please proceed.
All right, Mr. Chair, I will start with the amendments, hoping we can go through these quickly. First, I will move the A3 amendment, and what that does, members, is it removes two sections that were originally in the bill. And if, I'm not sure if members, if you have this handout, so it's section 3 is removed, and then we're removing the piece relating to newspapers so that nothing will change regarding the publishing of notices in newspapers. So that is the A3 amendment.
Questions regarding the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? A3 is adopted.
All right.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move the A2 amendment. The A2 amendment is the language that's in House File 1569, the Eklund 569. And I do have a question for Ms. Taylor. Ms. Taylor, do you know if this language incorporates the author's amendment, the updated language that's in our packets for 569?
Mr. Chair, members, it doesn't incorporate the A1 amendment.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this adds the provisions from 569, and Representative Eklund is here. If anyone has questions about that, I understand there's bipartisan support and is a request from local government that we do this.
Any questions from members regarding the adoption of this was the A two. Seeing none, all in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? A2 is adopted.
All right, Mr. Chair, now we will move the A4. The A4 amendment is something that Representative Lehman brought to me. It involves a community radio station in her district in Grand Rapids and is another issue that was brought to her by her constituents. Local government and the community radio station are in agreement, have asked us to do this so they can move their project along.
Any questions to the A4 amendment? There we go. Okay, we're going to get on the right page. Any questions to the A4 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A4, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? A4 is adopted. Do we have the bill in the shape you wish, Representative Becker-Finn?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, we do. And now I will turn it over to my testifier from the DNR to walk through, hopefully expediently, on the provisions that are in this year's lands bill.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Susan Damon. I'm the acting director of the DNR Division of Lands and Minerals. And I'm here to talk about the portions of the bill that were in the original House File 1586. For new members of the legislature, this is the DNR's 2019 lands bill, And the lands bill typically includes authorization for state park or state forest boundary changes, private sales of surplus land, and public sales of surplus land bordering water. The lands bill also typically includes technical or policy changes relating to real estate transactions. And this bill, as we've seen already this morning, gets combined with other bills generally relating to sales of tax-forfeited land and becomes the omnibus lands bill. Just a bit of background. In 2018, the DNR undertook a continuous improvement project about our land sales program, and a couple of the amendments in this proposed to law in this bill arise out of that continuous improvement project. So Section 1 changes the time period for publishing a notice of proposed conveyance to resolve boundary line issues affecting state land and adjacent land. It changes publication period from between 15 and 30 days before conveyance to at least 30 days before conveyance. This is a technical change that was recommended by our attorneys because the current law allows for only a 15-day window to get all of the signatures on a boundary line agreement, and that can sometimes be difficult to accomplish. Section 2 arises out of our continuous improvement project, and this amends Minnesota Statute Section 92.115 to increase from $50,000 to $100,000 the estimated market value of state land requiring an appraisal before it is offered for sale. We estimate that this will allow us to expedite the valuation process for a number of sale parcels. Section 3 was omitted. Section 4 is amending Minnesota Statute Section 94.09 to specify which state departments and agencies and universities the DNR must notify of lands that may be declared surplus. Under current law, we're required to send out 144 notices to state agencies, most of which do not have any interest in acquiring surplus state land. So this is an attempt to make our sales process more efficient by limiting the notices to those agencies and entities that may actually have an interest. Section 5 amends Minnesota Statute Section 9410. There are two changes here. One is a parallel to Section 2 and increases the amount from $50,000 to $100,000 of estimated market value for land requiring an appraisal. The next change, starting in line point 432, requires the DNR to first offer surplus state lands within the boundary of a federally recognized Indian tribes reservation to the tribe. Under current law, the DNR is required to notify counties, townships, cities, and school districts of surplus land and to offer them the opportunity to purchase the land. There is no such requirement in current law to offer the land to tribal governments, and so this amendment would change that and require the DNR to offer the tribal government the opportunity to purchase surplus state land within the reservation boundary. Section 6 is an addition to the boundary of Glendalow State Park in Otter Tail County. The addition is 152.95 acres, and this is a property that includes over 2,200 feet of undeveloped lakeshore on Blanche Lake. It's in a major bird migration corridor, and the county and township are supportive of this change. Section 7 deletes 10.1 acres from the boundary of St. Croix State Park, adjusting the statutory boundary to follow the curve of Trunk Highway 48. Section 8 authorizes the sale of 16 acres of surplus land bordering Perch Lake in Carlton County to the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. This parcel is isolated from other state land. It is within the reservation boundary. Section 9 authorizes the public sale of 0.54 acres of surplus land bordering Woman Lake in Cass County. Again, this is an isolated parcel of state land. It is a property that the DNR acquired as a gift. It was a Farmers Home Administration mortgage foreclosure. There are currently federal deed restrictions on the property. We're working with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to move those to another parcel and then would like to put it up for public sale. Section 10 authorizes the sale of 6.4 acres of surplus state land bordering Big Sand Lake in Hubbard County to the county at no cost. The property was originally acquired for public water access, but there are actually two other public water accesses on this same lake, and it is not needed. Section 11 authorizes the public sale of 4.9 acres of surplus state land bordering the Snake River in Kennebec County. When the DNR acquired this parcel, we made a commitment to Kennebec County to split the parcel and sell the portion that lies north of the Snake River. Section 12 authorizes the public sale of 0.48 acres of surplus state land bordering Big Pine Lake in Otter Tail County. This is land that is separated from the current public water access and not needed for public water access purposes. Section 13 authorizes the public sale of 10 acres of surplus land bordering the Zumbro River in Wabasha County. This is a Division of Forestry administered land. It's a small size parcel, and the terrain is steep, and it's difficult to manage for forest activity. The final section of the land authorizes the no-fee conveyance of 4.1 acres of surplus state land bordering Spelman Lake in Yellow Medicine County to the United States. This is a public water access, but the lake levels are low. It's primarily used by hunters who are accessing the adjacent Spelman waterfowl production area. The federal government will keep this open for public access. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Members, Ribs and Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions back on, I guess it would be Section 5, beginning at line 4.32. As I understand this, this would provide the tribal government at a reservation with first right of refusal. In other words, before any land could be disposed of, you would first have to go to the tribe. They would have to refuse, or I'm assuming they'd have to somehow respond and say no. Then if there was a local unit of government that existed within the tribal boundary, then they would have an opportunity if that land happened to somehow be a benefit to them. I guess, is that the correct stepping stones on how this would work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lewick, yes, that is correct.
And I guess, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the next question then, how many cities, local units of government, do we have within tribal boundaries? I believe we do have at least a fair number of small cities.
Ms. Damon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lewick, I would have to get that information for you. I don't have that at hand.
Yeah, I would suggest you maybe take a look at the White Earth boundaries. So I guess it would seem I've got no issue with the concept here, but it would seem like if we're going to do this that we would want to put the DNR in a position where they can basically get all proposals on the table before they have to make it a decision. When I say I'm talking specifically, there's other local units of government that may or may not have a legitimate need for this. It would seem that at this point the DNR has got to go here first before they can even make that offer. and that just seems like to get to the point quickly, it would seem like you just want to make the offer to everybody. Then the DNR is in a position where they can take a look, and they're going to have to make a judgment as to what might be the best, the appropriate thing to follow. It also looks like the tribes would have to pay full value, period, as I understand that, right? There's no negotiation. You pay fair market value, but you could turn right around and a local unit of government, you could make a completely different agreement that would literally be a dollar in consideration. Is that correct?
Ms. Damon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lewick, I believe that we currently do sell to local units of government for full market value under this provision.
There's no provision that you could negotiate something less. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lewick, we do have the ability under other sales laws there is a sales provision that allows us to go to the Executive Council and get authorization to sell for less than market value.
Yeah. You wouldn't be able to do that exclusively. So I guess I'm just a little concerned that we might want to take a look at this and make sure that we're treating all those local governments in the same manner as opposed to and I appreciate the you know, the concept here. It just it would seem like it could create a situation where it puts a local unit of government might have a legitimate need in a secondary position.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beckerfield.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lewick, and I guess this is a good opportunity to kind of inform folks of the history and why this provision is so important the way that it is written. The point is exactly to give the tribes the right of first refusal, and that I would, you know, I can't speak for the DNR, but I would guess that is in recognition of the history of why we have so much land within reservation boundaries that is not owned by the tribe. And that puts us back to the allotment period when, you know, it's kind of, you know, folks may be more familiar with the idea of 40 acres and a mule. You know, sort of the same sort of concept was done to our native communities where the federal government, to the detriment of native communities, decided that they were going to decide who was native and who was not. And instead of taking all of the land within the reservation, and like just to use an easier number, let's say there's 50 members of the tribe. Instead of taking that entire reservation and dividing it by 50 and dividing it up equally, they came up with a smaller number of acres that each person would get, and then they sold off the rest. And that is why we're in a situation where if, like, you look at Leech Lake, technically the boundaries of their reservation is one of the largest reservations in the country, but well over half the land within the reservation boundaries is not owned by Leech Lake. And that is problematic at best and speaks to a long history of putting our native communities and our native nations at a disadvantage. And so I think this provision does exactly what you said and would put our tribal governments in the first right of first refusal. That is exactly the point. But I would say that is good policy, and that's recognition of a history of why some of the disparities exist and kind of where we're at. And it also speaks to, you know, we just had Sovereignty Day. Our nations, they have sovereignty. They have rights that counties and cities and townships don't have. And, you know, there might be folks listening to this who don't like that, but that is the reality of our law. And so I think this is a recognition of that, and I think is an excellent provision that is good policy.
Thank you. Say, you're almost preaching to the choir on this. I you know, from a standpoint of Minnesota's past history. My only concern here is, though, that let's take a small town that's trying to work on a flood control issue or something, or they've got a street or a township that's trying to work on a road right away, and they simply want a little sliver of land to expand a road right away, or they need to do a flood control structure, something like that. And it would seem like we'd want to approach that just on a straightforward on the merit. I seriously doubt that a tribal government would object to something like that, but it just seems like we don't we don't allow for that, and so that's my only concern. That, in other words, we put the stepping order in there that you've got to go through a right of refusal before you could offer it to the rest of the potential folks. I'm only talking about a very tiny element here. I'm not talking about general land parcels. I'm talking about situations where you have a local unit of government there that's got responsibilities, just like the tribal government, to serve their citizens. And if they needed a small piece of land, they're put in a second position. And in both cases, we're trying to serve a general public good.
Mr. Chair.
President Becker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill, I mean, this language does allow for that. It's as simple as the tribe saying no thank you. You know, right of first refusal sounds like very legal and like that's potentially something very complicated, but it isn't necessarily complicated. And I would guess in most of our communities, you know, if it is an issue of flood control or some other, you know, general public good, I would think that all of our governments would be working together to address that. So, I mean, the option is there. It's not like it's making in this imaginary scenario, it's not like it's saying that the county absolutely, you know, that the tribe absolutely has to buy it or that the county absolutely could not buy it. It's just asking them first.
If I may, let me just jump in a little bit. I'm just going to relay to you, in my 41 years on Leech Lake Reservation, the cooperation between communities, many in the communities are native, as you know, and it's working pretty good at this point, especially with the counties and the communities. So.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, yes, I'll follow on with that. I think particularly Aiken County has got a significant amount of tribal land spread out throughout the county in some fairly concentrated areas. But and so, no, I'd say I'm just talking about one little thing here way down the road that would seem like the we just need to be aware of that there could be a use. I believe White Earth is the only tribal government that has got actual operating municipalities within the boundaries of the reservation, but I could be mistaken.
Yeah, Leech Lake has several.
Okay, yeah.
So it's working pretty good, but thank you for your concern. Looking further, Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have some questions, but first I just want to clarify on this conversation that you're having now. Because something that always gets passed by, and there's no secret that I am against public land, and I don't care who owns them. I don't care if it's a tribe, the state, the federal government. They're killing us in greater Minnesota. And the White Earth Nation is finding that out now, too, because there's a severe lack of funding. And they don't have a funding source. And the more land that disappears is takes away our local funding source. But that's maybe an argument for another day. I think that in Manoman County, at least, we already practice this. So the language isn't really going to do much for or against my county. But I do need to make clear, you know, we always talk about reservation land, like somehow or another, it's either part of the reservation or it's owned by somebody who's not native, and that's simply not true. It's just simply not true. There's many hundreds, if not thousands, of acres that are owned by members of the nation, including me. I own my own land. I pay property taxes on my own land. So there's members of the tribe, and I'm sure Leech Lake is the same. I'm not familiar with Leech Lake, but on White Earth, it's open reservation. But it's not just you're not just hurting non-tribal members when you take this stuff off of the private sales, because there's a lot of people out there who are native that want to own their own property. So that's just my little vent that never gets talked about. But I do have a couple of questions. There's a land sale in this is for the testifier. There's a land sale in Hubbard County, and they're selling back a piece of property that was at one time purchased by the DNR for a lake access. Can you tell me where that is and something about, you know, a little bit about that property? Does it have a house on it? Did it have a house on it before they purchased it?
Ms. Damon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, no, I do not believe it has a house on it. It's on the southern part of Big Sand Lake, and it is adjacent to tax forfeited land. And the DNR would like to convey that property to Hubbard County at no cost, and Hubbard County would like to combine it with that tax forfeited land parcel and sell it.
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair, I'm thrilled at that. I really am. But the reason that I brought it up is because a few years ago we had a huge battle over a parcel that they were going to use to expand, the DNR was going to use to expand access to the water. It was worth over $300,000. The people put it up for sale and got an offer on it. And the DNR, who will tell you time and again that they don't outbid people, came in and upped the bid by $20,000, bought the land away from a private person, and I believe they tore down the house. And I was just wondering if this was the one that they now decided. So I'll check that out. The other one is in Section 14, although probably not a very big piece of property, it's in Yellow Medicine County. Now, this land is going to be given over to the United States. Now, on this piece of property, is there PILT payments now, or and will there be after it's conveyed over to the United States government?
Ms. Dame.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, yes, there are PILT payments on the property now. I don't have the exact figure of what those are, and I believe that there would be federal PILT on the property after it's conveyed. I can try to verify that for you.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd appreciate that. And one last thing in Section 13, I think this is the one, where you're going to sell a piece of property that's not manageable. And I see this a lot in the DNR when you look up what is being sold. And a lot, you know, quite a few of the parcels that you see are either half underwater, no public access, and no one's going to buy them. No one can buy them. And so I'm wondering, Is there any viable use for this small piece of property that you're putting up for sale?
Ms. Dame.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, the Division of Forestry is the administrator of this parcel, and they have determined that it's difficult to conduct forestry activity on the parcel. As you know, the DNR has a lot of parcels that were acquired, you know, many years ago, and perhaps we were not applying the same strict acquisition criteria that we are. We're continually evaluating our land portfolio and trying to determine which parcels we should keep, which parcels we should divest of. And my assumption is that this is, and I can go back and get more information about this parcel for you, but my assumption is that this is a parcel that's been in state ownership for quite some time, and it probably would not be the kind of parcel that we would acquire today.
Thank you. Just real quickly, Mr. Chair, on the bill on page 5, lines 5.5 through 5.7, it says that the tribe has up to 2 years from the date of accepted offer to begin paying for the lands in the manner provided by law. Can you walk me through that, what that means, and then also would we provide the same opportunity to other units of government?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, that under current law, a local unit of government also has up to 2 years to begin paying for the property. So they would provide us notice of interest, and then they might need to raise the funds or seek the funds to actually make the payment, and then we hold that property for 2 years.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Very good. I have no other members on the list for questions and comments. Anybody in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none. Representative Becker Finn, some closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank everyone for the discussion on the always exciting annual lands bill. And I would renew my motion, well, I guess, move that House File 1586 as amended be referred to Ways and Means.
Very good. You've heard the motion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Bill is moving to Ways and Means, Representative Beckerpin. Thank you. Representative Brown.
Good morning.
Good morning and welcome, and please, if you would, we need to get the right paper in front of me here, sorry. Okay, so I'm gonna move that House File 1509 be laid over for possible inclusion, Representative Brand, and if you would please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House File 1509 seeks an appropriation for the Minnesota River in order to set a new river eutrophication standard for the main channel of the Minnesota River. I represent District 19A, and on two edges of the border are the Minnesota River, and so it's a large part of my district is the Minnesota River, and I would like to have a chance to have my testifier today, Pat Hanges from the city of Mankato, testify also on this bill. But I will say that, you know, overall, the Minnesota River is unhealthy. You know, sediment clouds the water, phosphorus causes algae, nitrogen poses a risk to humans and fish. We've got some issues that we need to address. And the standard that we have right now isn't working. And so what we're asking is for a new standard that is perhaps a little bit more equitable for all the communities and all the partners up and down the river. And with that, I would like to pass it to Pat Hendricks to testify.
Mr. Hendricks, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
I'm Pat Hendricks, H-E-N-T-G-E-S. I'm with the city of Mankato. I'm the city manager. Chairman, basically at this point in time, Mankato and I would point out St. Peter really have been leaders in the development of water quality initiatives along the river. We have a long history really of going above and beyond essentially the standards that are imposed on us and in efforts to really ensure that the stakeholders in this river really can enjoy high quality recreation and agriculture and essentially domestic water in the case of Mankato. We are leaders in the MS4 program in stormwater discharge. We have a leading program in nitrate trading. We've been one of the water reclamation projects in the state. And we've also developed a number of non-point treatment projects in terms of runoff. I would also point out that 75% of Mankato's water comes from shallow river collector wells. So the river is paramount to our success and our economic vitality. We brought this legislation forward as we have concerns with river eutrophication standards that are being proposed for the Minnesota River. We believe the standards are not a strategy that will really result in addressing the water quality challenges along the river. In the first part of the bill, we actually propose allocating funding to the MPCA for a site-specific standard. We believe that the current one-size-fit-all standard really does not, when applied to the Minnesota River, really does not result in improvement in algal growth. And in other words, it won't do anything really for a emerging algal problem. We are not asking that the agency lower or raise the standard. We simply are asking that we use a standard that's tailored to the unique characteristics and aspects of the Minnesota River. The Minnesota River is different than the St. Croix or the pools of on upper Mississippi. It has a unique characteristic. It has a lot of dynamics to it. We've been raising this issue for nearly 3 years with the MPCA, It's been, very frankly, quite hard to get the data, a straight answer in terms of the standards from their proposing and what they claim they will do. We've hired two different experts at a cost of, to the city of Mankato, $100,000 to address this issue. Very frankly, with the new administration, we're encouraged. Just last week, a long attempted meeting with, or this past week, I should say, a long attempted meeting with our scientific expert occurred with the MPCA scientists, and we believe we're on the right path. With respect to the second part of the bill, and this is just as important, our goal is really to develop an actual plan to address water quality issues in the Minnesota River. We believe that part of that bill will involve incentives for a trading program, expanding what we're doing on point-to-point trading, but also non-point-to-point source trading. The second part, we hope that we can allocate funding to optimize wastewater treatment plant facilities, make sure the investment that we all are making, the 40 point sources along that river, that we're making the right investments and optimizing the capital investment that our local citizens and the state of Minnesota participate in. And then finally, I think the final aspect of the stakeholder group will be to develop management practices for non-point source projects. We have, for example, a demonstration project that we're proposing. It's about a $10 million project, and we think that can be one of the many examples in terms of achieving water quality from non-point sources. We recognize that really the top-down government approach for stakeholder groups just, very frankly, hasn't worked. And that's why we're asking that Minnesota State University, the Water Resource Center, which has a strong history in the area, a lot of support in the area, essentially be the facilitator or convening group of this stakeholder group. Understand that this stakeholder is a voluntary process. We're hoping we can bring together the environmentalists, the agricultural community, the other stakeholders along this river, and convene this group. We believe that that facilitation really is best served by an independent group as opposed to a state agency. Again, pulling this all together, we believe we want the right standard. We want the stakeholder process, and in fact, that is something that has been supported in the past discussions with MPCA, but this is a little bit different approach. Very frankly, we think we can come up with innovative solutions in bringing the stakeholders together and coming up with a better future for the Minnesota River.
Very good. Looking for any member questions or comments? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, you talked about a new standard, and you use the word standard in a singular fashion. Would this one standard include standards for various pollutants, or are we looking at a standard?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the standards that we're looking at is essentially river eutrophication standard is something that would be applied across all rivers. And essentially what we're asking for is that we're looking at a standard site-specific to the Minnesota River. And that, very frankly, that's a risk. It could be lower or it could be above the current standards. I would point out this bit of information, and I hope this is helpful. As I understand the standards today, we get the city of Mankato, which is the largest point source, we can meet it. What we're concerned about is it the right standard that will show water quality improvements on the river? And that's, I think, our end goal here is let's get it right if we're being called upon across the 40 point source dischargers that we want to see real water quality improvements. And I think that's been our concern all along. If we're going to make that investment, we want to make the right investment, and we want to see results from it.
Mm-hmm. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up question on procedure. I think I heard you right when you said this bill was going to be laid over for possible inclusion, yet it contains $1 million in funding. Doesn't this have to go to a finance committee?
Eventually, it certainly may. Representative
Look. I had a question on page 2, line 2.1. As I understand this, if we come up with this standard, then the commissioner has 60 days to recommend approval or denial. Who's he going to recommend that approval to, and does that start rulemaking if assuming that they recommended approval? What's you walk me through how that would work? What's that going to lead to?
Mr. Hendrick?
Essentially, Mr. Chair, Representative, if at this point in time, the rule, the river eutrophication standards are in place. Mm-hmm. Essentially, if we have a site-specific standard, there will have to be a rulemaking process. There will not have to be a rulemaking process. This will take the place of what is in place.
I guess that while there's a lot of folks involved here, that wouldn't have to go back out for a public look. Yes or no? I mean, if it's no, that's the answer. Yes, but that seems like a
we're calling the bullpen up
short,
here.
Yeah, short stopping.
please introduce yourself for the record and. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, committee, my name is Daniel Marks. I'm an environmental attorney with the law firm of Flaherty and Hood, and I've been working with the city of Mankato on this matter.
And did you hear the question, or do you need to have that repeated?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's my understanding the question is, so if the site-specific standard goes back to the proposal, goes back to the commissioner, kind of what's the process? So under existing law, there is a process for developing site-specific standards. And if the commissioner or the PCA approves the standard, they would essentially issue a preliminary approval or a draft document for a 45-day public notice. So it's different than rulemaking, but there's a public engagement requirement, a part of that. And then that site-specific standard would also require final approval from U.S. EPA before it would become effective in the state of Minnesota.
I understand. Thank you. And then that would then be applied to any and all permits that would be impacted?
Mr. Chair, Representative, so if the site-specific standard were approved by the PCA and then U.S. EPA, that would be the, assuming that it would apply to the Minnesota River, that would be the applicable eutrophication standard for the Minnesota River that would apply to the point sources on that river.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Very good. I'm going to go with Representative Wagenius, and then we're going to bring MPCA down to get their testimony.
Thank you. I appreciated you're bringing up some work you were doing. I think you said you were investing $10 million in a specific thing, and I just wanted to hear what you were doing. It was a general statement. Is there some specifics here you can share with us?
Go ahead.
Representative Wagenius, essentially we have a large portion of a watershed that drains into the southern part of Mankato, and that watershed carries a county ditch, a series of agricultural areas. Essentially, what we are doing in place is putting in a large wetland, a large treatment cell. We are investigating bioreactors, essentially filtering the ditch water. And then it goes into a traditional stormwater system. Unfortunately, in Mankato's geography, it flows back out of the city into ravine systems, causing additional runoff. Then it goes to an area before it discharges, and we're creating another level of treatment for that before it discharges into the Blue Earth Lesueur River system, which ultimately goes into the Minnesota. So this effort is that we've determined that there is a significant amount of treatment in addition to our normal MS4 treatment for phosphorus, nitrates, and suspended solids that this system will treat prior to getting in the city, going out of the city, and ultimately discharging in directly into the river. One of our concerns is we believe there's a lot of opportunities kind of right at the point of discharge for a lot of non-point projects in Minnesota. And I know St. Peter, for example, has a great amount of concern with discharge coming through the city affecting their well systems, and they're looking at similar management practices. You're seeing that all up and down the river, that municipalities in concert with their counties are working on these management best practices projects.
If I could follow up with one question.
Please, Representative Gaines.
Is this a process you're using to protect your drinking water wells?
Representative, essentially in this particular case, this watershed that drains goes into another collector well that has historically had nitrate problems also. But the purpose of this essentially is to better manage the rural runoff that comes into the city, into our system, and causes erosion problems, ultimately discharge problems, and flow problems during high flows in our influences our wells. But it has an impact on our domestic system, but just generally water quality.
So if I can understand that this, I mean, one of the purposes here is to protect your drinking water wells.
One of the purposes.
Yes, thank you.
Very good. I do have Representative Boa. I was going to bring MPCA down. Do you want to go first?
I can go first and I'll be quick.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Brands, as a representative for District 47B, which borders the Minnesota River, I applaud the efforts to try to have a positive impact on the river because it does need some help. But a couple of points or questions, I guess, would be the timelines seem fairly tight for some of these action steps to be taken, so I just wondered thoughts on that. Secondly, though, when I see the word trading, I always get really nervous about creating another layer of bureaucracy and a potential impact for farmers with costs and regulatory burden and that sort of thing, and I wonder if you could just address those for me.
Representative Brand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Bo. Ultimately, that's why I'm here. I'm here because we want to clean that river, and that's the only reason that this piece of legislation is before us right now in committee is because I feel strongly that what we're doing isn't working, and this is an opportunity for something different. The timeline is a bit tight, but I think that there are a lot of folks, there are a lot of stakeholders along the Minnesota River that have an interest in water quality. And I think that this particular bill, honestly, I think threads a needle. There are a lot of interests up and down the river that that may have competing interests and also interests that are shared. And I think that this is an opportunity for us to have a conversation about what we can do to ultimately create a new standard that's better for our river, better for our communities, better for the folks up and down the river.
Mr. Hedman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we already trade with seven, right now it's seven partners. Two of them are some of the larger agri producers on the river.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a good trade relationship. We believe that there is a lot of opportunities, particularly as we've demonstrated with our project, to do point to non-point source trading. We're not looking at a mandate. We believe that what we have established has been a good program, has resulted in real water quality, and there are other additional opportunities in the basin for additional non-point-to-point or point-to-non-point source trading opportunities that will result in real water quality improvements.
Very good. I'm going to get MPCA down here. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, while their MPC is coming down,
yeah,
thank you. The motion on this bill is to lay it over.
Yes, sir.
I would strongly encourage you to change your motion. If we're going to be serious about doing this,
mm-hmm.
Okay, we need to move this to one of the finance committees,
yeah,
so that we can continue having this conversation. Representative Brand said he feels very strongly about this. I think that if we want to do something more than just have a conversation about it,
mm-hmm.
we actually need to take action on the bill and move it to a finance committee. So, Mr. Chair, I would strongly encourage you to change your motion.
Representative Fabian, I'll consider that, and we'll talk about it again tonight.
Thank you.
Okay. We have a pollution control agency. Please come forward and introduce yourselves and tell us about how good the bill is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Greta Gauthier, Assistant Commissioner, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you for allowing us the opportunity to speak to this bill. I just want to say that we have met with Representative Brand a couple times about this bill and will continue to do so. I'm going to turn it over to one of our staff who has expertise in this area, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Luckstein, and I'm the manager of the Municipal Wastewater Section at the Pollution Control Agency. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. The agency does have concerns with this bill as it is written. This bill assumes that the Minnesota River needs a site-specific standard because it responds differently to phosphorus than other water bodies. To date, the agency has not seen compelling evidence that that is the case. While we acknowledge and while we are confident that the current standard, which was developed in 2015, is the correct one for this river, we also acknowledge that it is a complex river system, and because of those complexities, people want assurance that the goal is correct, and we are open to learning more about the specifics of the Minnesota River and the factors that do contribute to phosphorus and algal growth in the system. So towards that end, we have been in communication with the city in order for them to achieve their goal of ensuring that the reductions that they make, as well as the reductions that others in the river make, do have a meaningful impact. And ultimately, as we work with the city, that work may show that the Minnesota River does truly act differently than other rivers and that a site-specific standard is needed. As the city mentioned, that standard could be higher or it could be lower. In considering a site-specific standard for the Minnesota River, the agency needs to consider downstream impacts. The Mississippi River, the St. Croix, and the Minnesota Rivers are all interconnected. We know that in order to achieve our water quality goals in the metro area, as well as at Lake Pepin, that the Minnesota River at around the Jordan area needs to achieve 150 milligrams per liter of phosphorus, or perhaps even lower. So even if analysis shows that phosphorus levels could go up in the Minnesota River, then additional reductions would be needed by downstream users in order to protect those downstream rivers and lakes. So if a site-specific standard is justified by the science, the agency would be happy to proceed in developing one and getting approved by EPA. However, until that happens, we believe that the current language of this bill, which mandates the creation of a site-specific standard, is premature. We look forward to working with the city of Mankato and the other cities to improve the understanding of phosphorus in the Minnesota River, and we will continue those discussions with them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Luckstein. And Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just to be clear, then the position of the Walz administration and the MPCA on this particular piece of legislation is you support it, you're neutral, or you're opposed to it.
Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Fabian. Mr. Chairman, we have concerns with the bill, Representative Fabian, and we are willing to work with the city to explore some of their concerns further. And we do not support the language as it's written right now.
Thank you.
Yeah. Other member questions, comments? Anybody in the audience that's looking to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I'm going to renew my motion. I'm going to amend it just slightly that we're just going to lay it on the table, mm-hmm. and we will take up discussion this evening again on where this legislation is headed. So, Representative Fabian.
Do we need to vote on a motion to lay it on the table, Mr. Chair?
No, we have to motion.
Say again. Representative Bryan.
You know, I'm not sure that we need to wait till 7:45 tonight to have more discussion on this bill. You know, I would actually ask that we do move this bill along to the Finance Committee, and we can have more conversations about it at the next stop. Ways to make the bill better, honestly, as well. Whatever works best. I realize that this bill threads an interesting needle, but there are a lot of players up and down the Minnesota River that have asked previous administrations, the previous governor, for this. And we haven't gotten anywhere. And we're hopeful with this new leadership and the new opportunities that exist, we can actually bend their ear and get this going.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You could lay it on the table, but I will move to lay it on the table.
Very good. We have the motion in front of us to lay the bill on the table. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Lay the bill on the table. Thank you, Representative Brand.
Confusing us. I don't know what's happening.
And we aren't adjourning. We are going to recess until 7:45, quarter to 8 this evening. Just come to order here and we'll be done before midnight. Can you bring a pillow? Good. Maybe we'll be done in a half hour here. We'll see. I just wanted to let the committee know we had earlier date laid the brand bill, House File 1509, on the table. And we're going to leave it on the table, and Representative Brand's going to work on his bill, and we'll bring it up next week again. So that's where we are with that. So our first bill this evening is House File 1706. Representative Lipper. So, let me look here at what our...
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 1706 be referred to Ways and Means.
Very good. We have the bill in front of us, and please tell us about the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Minnesota Statutes Chapter 103C is the Soil and Water Conservation District's law. However, duties and obligations for SWCDs are also in various other areas of statute. This bill provides those statutory cross-references in 103C and incorporates simple text on the range of SWCD services, helping to better articulate what SWCDs do, how they do it, and the legal obligations the state has put upon them. This time I'll turn it over to Sheila Vanney, who can say more about the bill.
See if that microphone works, first of all.
And sorry about any feedback. You think it's me? Oh. Mr. Chair.
Some feedback going on.
Thank you.
I know. Yeah.
All the little back of here is starting anyway, right? Well,
I can go forward, Mr. Chair, if that's okay.
Let's get through this if we can. Sorry about the noise.
No problem. Mr. Chair, committee members, Sheila Vanny. I'm the MASWCD Assistant Director, and I want to thank Representative Lippert for carrying the bill that's before you today. House File 1706 contains technical changes to 103C that are really just intended to capture the statutory references carrying obligations for SWCDs that are currently in other areas of statute and bring them all under one roof into 103C SWCD law. So we have obligations under the Wetland Conservation Act that's in 103G, the Soil Loss and Riparian Buffer Law that's in 103F, the Ag Water Quality Certification Program that's in, 17.9891. I could go on down the list, but really I think what this is trying to capture is all of the varied state responsibilities that are being expressed in other areas of statute into 103C, so that it's very clear when someone looks at the SWCD law what their wide and varied responsibilities are. That's section one of the bill. Section two is really just intended to explain how typically SWCDs go about implementing on those responsibilities. So providing technical expertise, performing administrative services, providing information and outreach, facilitating regulatory processes and trying to keep landowners out of regulatory harm's way, administering projects and programs, monitoring and inventorying, maintaining a modern technology infrastructure. Those are just elements of what we need to have a complete operation in order to fulfill our obligations under state law. So, Mr. Chair, those are my explanatory comments, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Very good. Member, questions on the bill in front of us?
One other note, Mr. Chair, I would just want to convey that the bill does not give SWCDs any new authorities, and it doesn't take any existing authorities away. So it's not substantively changing what we're obligated to do. It's just putting it all in 103C.
Very good. Seeing no question from members. Anybody in the audience wanting to testify on House File 1706? Nobody's running up there. So, I guess, Representative Lippert, some final comments?
I think this is self-explanatory, Mr. Chair. So I would renew my motion to refer the bill to Ways and Means, House File 1706.
Very good. Motion in front of us. All in favor of the bill, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? On your way. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next bill on the agenda is House File 1284. Representative Purcell, would you like to move your bill?
I will. Excuse me, I will, but...
Ways and Means.
I move that House File 1284 be referred to Ways and Means.
All right, we have House File 1284 in front of us. Chair Purcell, to your bill. Go ahead.
Well, just a little bit of background. Folks that have been at the legislature for a while have seen bills like 1284 before, but just some comments. I wanted to get a couple things out there. As many know, funding for soil and water conservation districts is a shared state and local obligation. And similar to other locally elected government entities, SWCDs need a portion of funding come from state, and SWCDs need authority to raise their own local revenue through statutory funding. So SWCDs currently rely on counties for a significant portion of their funding. That reliance, however, has produced an uneven level of SWCD funding across the state, often leaving any given SWCD significant unmet needs. Even with incentives to counties through SWCD capacity, funding matching opportunities, many counties have not contributed adequate funds for SWCD operations. As an elected unit of government, I was on an SWCD board at one time, SWCDs are accountable to their constituents, and SWCDs should not be fully dependent on another unit of government. SWCDs need statutory options for raising their own local revenue where needed, including property tax level levy. I would, at this point, would like to turn it over to testifier here with me, Mr. Cleveland.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Roland Cleveland. I have the honor of serving as president of the Minnesota Association of Soil Water Conservation Districts, or MASWCD. I'm an elected supervisor, Lucius-Sigel Soil and Water Conservation District. And the MASWCD represents 440 locally elected SWCD board members and 470 employees. Thank you. I want to thank Representative Purcell for carrying this bill, and thank you, Madam Chair, for providing the opportunity to discuss this bill today. I'd like to speak to the SWCD funding issues from a statewide perspective, giving a little background on the issue, explaining our need, and also noting the guardrails that are in our proposed funding authorities. Then I'll turn it over to the next testifier. A little bit of background, you just heard a little bit laid out in 103C, as well as various other places in statute, are obligations placed on SWCDs to be a technical and financial resource for our local communities. We identify local resource priorities, put together plans on how to address them in a targeted fashion, and then we assess how we're doing and where more attention needs to be placed. However, we're often hindered from fully implementing our plans because of operational funding constraints. SWCD funding is and should be shared state and local obligation. Unfortunately, right now, both the state and the local shared have serious flaws that need to be addressed. I'd like to direct you to one of our handouts showing our current funding mix and shortfalls going into next year and how we're proposing to address these shortfalls with local and state funds. It's the one Sheila's holding up here. Regarding the local share and the impetus of this bill, SWCDs, unlike other local units of government, do not have a means of raising our own revenues. We rely on fundings from the counties for their support. And we do appreciate the local investments that have been made and continue to be made across Minnesota. In some cases, these local investments have been adequate to hire, retain qualified staff with expertise of various natural resource areas. In many cases where funding has been lacking, hiring and retaining top-notch staff has been extremely challenging. The median county allocations to SWCDs in 2017 were just over $90,000 per SWCDs. And keep in mind, one SWCD basically gets about $1 million, so that $90,000 is a little bit skewed on what the average SWCD gets. What this bill provides is three options for SWCDs to pursue. First is status quo. Relationship with the county is will continue with county allocations, the SWCD, where that SWCD believes it is working well. Second would be an ad valorem property tax levy for the SWCDs to raise revenue based on property tax values capped at 0.048% of taxable market value or $1 million, whichever is less. Another option would be for SWCDs to institute a fee for SWCDs to raise revenues based on locally adopted decisions. For example, it could include a per acre or per household, per parcel. There's no end of options, and it could be as complicated as or as simple as the locals wanted to make it. And you know, there also would be potentially with the fee system, there could be an option that you have a base fee, but then if you put in an incentive practice that maybe your fee could be reduced because you've reduced part of what you're contributing to the problem. Both the levy and fee would be subject to public notice, public hearing requirements typical of these authorities. I'd like to point your attention to a handout we distributed that breaks down these funding scenarios, what it would look like for a few SWCDs across the state. As you look at this, you can see the cost to constituents per $100,000 raised for an SWCDs are not unreasonable in light of the important work being done by the SWCDs and the fact that SWCDs also, most SWCDs leverage local and state dollars with federal dollars for an even better bang on the buck. Regarding state share funding for SWCDs, the state contribution is currently in doubt. It was not included in the governor's budget proposal, but we're working with Representative Fisher on a bill that the government's for appropriations for SWC to solidify the state share of the SWCD funding. SWCD funding authority is not to replace state capacity funding, but be another option for raising the local match to share state funds. I'd like to point out that as a local government elected official, I am accountable to the public that I serve. I'm not afraid of public notice, public hearings, you know, and these authorities should come with these oversight procedures. In conclusion, Chair, I'd like to again thank you for graciously allowing the time to bring this to your attention. I'd be happy to answer any questions at this point or turn it over to our next testifier.
Mr. Cleveland, it looks like Representative Green has a question.
Madam Chair, if there's another testifier, I can wait till they're done.
We'll move on to the next testifier. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Lord. I'm the district manager for the Anoka County Soil and Water Conservation District. I have been working there about just under 28 years now. I do want to thank you for hearing this and the committee members for hearing and considering our testimony, and thank you, Representative Purcell, for carrying this bill. The struggles during the 1930s Dust Bowl, and don't be afraid that I'm harkening back to the 30s, I'm going to make this quick. our struggles to feed the country and provide clean, safe drinking water during the Dust Bowl opened our eyes as a country to the need to proactively manage our natural resources. Prior to then, there was nothing. Soil and water conservation districts were then authorized by federal action. And through local petition, they popped up and spread to cover every acre in the state of Minnesota and 3,000 of us nationwide. So we are networked nationally of 3,000 offices like ours. As locally elected special purpose entities dedicated to managing soil productivity, drinking water, lakes, rivers, wildlife, threatened endangered species, the list goes on and on. We are the foundation for natural resource management across Minnesota and the nation. By providing technical assistance and financial incentives to private landowners to enact conservation activities, we reach the 80% of Minnesota on private lands that state agencies can't. And without reaching that 80% of the land, we couldn't be effective. Funding for SWCDs varies by states. Now in Minnesota, counties retain control of the purse strings by ensuring that financial support from counties to SWCDs was optional. And as the only governmental unit in Minnesota with an elected board and no form of local taxing authority, SWCDs have never really been empowered to do our jobs with a level of responsiveness, efficiency, and effectiveness that we expect of local government. Some counties do support their SWCDs well, but by and large, SWCDs lose the budget battles year after year to issues like public safety, transportation, social services, economic development, and the list goes on, as you can imagine. Poor financial support, in fact, is fairly common. And in 2016, 52 out of the 86 SWCDs received less than $100,000 in county support, and that's to run their entire office. That averages out to less than 0.5% of the county's budgets. So I'd ask, how much thought, time, and effort should we expect of county government to invest in an issue that represents less than 0.5% of what they do? Regardless of how important that issue is to our quality of life and our economy. And I think anecdotally, if you think of all the logos of every city and county across the state, what do they have on them? It's herons and lakes and rivers and the things that Minnesotans hold dear. So we know it's important to us all. So if Minnesota's natural resources are worth managing, they're worth managing well. So we need to fix the system. And that's what legislatures do. SWCDs who do have the motivation and commitment to effectively manage our natural resources have lacked the sufficient financial support. And so to achieve efficient, effective natural resource management, we need to empower those with the will and the expertise to take action and then hold them accountable for outcomes through local planning, budgeting, and the election process. And we welcome that opportunity and have for the last 70 to 80 years. When we don't do this, the result is a trickle of unaddressed needs that result in the incremental creation of complex network of regulation and governmental layers. So each added layer is rational and defensible in the moment to address some need. It's essentially putting your finger in a hole in the dam. But collectively, the system becomes really confusing. It can be top-heavy, and it can be inefficient. Taxpayers don't mind paying for natural resource management, provided the spending is done intelligently. What taxpayers don't want and don't deserve is redundancy, regulatory complexity, inefficiency, and ineffectiveness. And so to address some of those issues that we deal with because of our funding cycle, just a few bullets, if we were empowered to do our jobs well and address local natural resource issues over the last 70 to 80 years, how much of our current regulatory framework may have been unnecessary? Could we have sidestepped? How much in the future, as we start talking about emerging concerns like pharmaceuticals and hormones and nitrates and groundwater, and the list goes on, and I don't need to keep going there for you, but how many future regulations might we be able to sidestep? In terms of efficiency, surviving on grants, SWCDs are caught in a cycle of building programs, dismantling, rebuilding, dismantling, rebuilding again. As an example, my office, this year I have a $2 million budget. My county's contribution is $150,000. So you can imagine trying to keep that consistent. Next year it could be $1.5 million, then $2.2. It's very difficult to be efficient and to keep the talent. And that comes down to the effectiveness. To recruit, train, and retain talent with such uncertainty when they're trying to raise families is so difficult. They want to pay their mortgages, as we all do. And so to keep that talent in Minnesota working for us after we've invested so much time in them, we need a certain level of stability, and that's where this bill comes in. So again, if Minnesota's natural resources are worth managing, they're worth managing well. So think about the ideal system for a moment. This is where I think probably a lot of you are drawn into public service to fix broken government. So we come to you to help fix our natural resource management system. And so some ideals of local government and effective government, I would argue, are a single statewide system that manages all of our natural resources, not just water, but we're talking not just surface water, groundwater, forestry, lakes, rivers, endangered species, flyways, the wetlands, whatever it happens to be that is so locally important to an economy, that's what should be getting the attention. And it should be from one source, not a whole bunch of different sources. So you know exactly who to call every time, and you're going to get the expert on the phone, and they'll be accountable to you. Locally elected and accountable is critical, dedicated to natural resource management. It's more than 0.5% of what you do. I have an elected board. It is 100% of what they do. It's all they think about when they're working for me. All of my staff, it's all we do all day. cost effectiveness. Frankly, we essentially having the last 70, 80 years under our belt is essentially like growing up in the Depression in terms of financing. We have a culture of effectiveness. We have a culture of looking at every one of our programs every year and deciding, is this a smart program? Is it an effective program? Do we need to revamp it or trash it and reinvent it? So that is something you get when you invest in us. Collaborative across jurisdictions to manage resources at whatever level. We don't need to organize government based on a watershed to manage surface water. That government won't be very well suited to manage groundwater. It won't be very well suited to manage a flyway region or endangered species or prairie chicken habitat or whatever the local priority is. And then focus on technical assistance and incentives to avoid the unnecessary regulation. So our statewide network of SWCDs provides everything I just listed, and so we can be the ideal system. To efficiently and effectively deliver on these, though, the only missing element is adequate funding, which is what this bill does provide. So in closing, I just want to thank you again, Madam Chair, and committee members, and for taking your time to listen to this and consider this seriously. And just say Minnesota's resources are worth managing. I think they're worth managing well. Thank you.
And Chair Purcell, do you have any additional testifiers?
I don't believe so for now. Okay. Not for now.
Okay. Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Wow. Members, do you realize what you just heard? We are sitting here today, and we are witnessing the birth of another agency. Because this gentleman just sat there and said that it is likely his intention to take over all the other agencies that we have in greater Minnesota. And I can tell you right now, the taxpayers of Minnesota can't afford that. We're going into a situation here where we're going to allow another agency to start levying people who are already property tax poor. And if you've served on any committees with me, you know I tell you every time I get a chance that we are losing people every year who can't afford to pay their property taxes now. And now we're going to add to the DNR, the MPCA, watershed districts, and Bowser, and we're going to create another agency here. We don't need, nor do we want, another agency with taxing authority. The SWCDs are pretty popular out there right now, and one of the reasons is that they're small. They're small, and they can come into an area and talk to people. People like to talk to them. They used to think that about Bowser, believe it or not, until Bowser got so big and top-heavy. Now Bowser is almost on the same class of hatred as DNR and the MPCA. And our watershed districts are losing their popularity very fast, too, because they too are growing to a point and they're using their taxing authority and people have no idea how to combat them. And they're even worse because they're not elected. I know that other people have questions, and so I'm not going to ask all of or go through all of my stuff. But if we want to keep this, put it this way. If this agency has been operating successfully since, what did you say, 1930? Why are we changing it? This is a bad way to go. I'm sorry to see this bill. I am going to be out in my district and as far, many as I can across the state talking about the birth of an agency here and what it's going to mean for us in the taxing, on the tax levies. The other thing is most people don't even know what an SWCD is. And so when they're going to hold their Board of Equalization, where are they going to hold it? And people are going to have to come in and give their input on the new tax that's coming up. And then are they going to have to go to the county like we do in the townships? We don't know. Where are these things going to be held? And, you know, I just think this is a bad way to go. I hope this bill does not move forward.
Representative Purcell, any response?
No, not at this time. We've been down this road a number of times over the last 20 years or more, and as a former SWCD board member, I tell you, it's tough, and they do good hard work out there and prevent a lot of pollution, especially in Lake Country, I'm going to say. So undersung and underfunded, and we'll see where this goes. We've got to find funding for them.
Representative Green.
Well, to that I would say, you know, with all due respect, Representative Purcell, and to your testifiers, I hear this all the time. You know, our process of moving forward in government is always slow, and we're talking about taxing the citizens who are all already overtaxed. It should move slow. And when agencies come and talk to people out in the field, if the farmer or the rancher or anyone else out there, the lake owner, says to these agencies, I can't do this, it's just too hard, the answer is too bad. But our agencies come to us and say, the process that we have that we've been using for 50, 60, 70 years is just too hard. So make it easier for us. No, I don't think that's the right way to go.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. SWCDs do a good job. They have a good reputation, a good relationship with farmers, in my opinion, and you do good work. And the funding thing has been an issue for a long time. But I just want to ask the testifiers a question, and I don't know this answer. I want to get your opinion. And I think one of the reasons you've had a good relationship with I'll say, farmers, is that you're not a taxing authority. And I'm just wondering if you think that relationship may change if you become able to levy taxes, and I wouldn't want to see that relationship damaged. Do you think that would have any impact on how you get along and work with farmers?
Mr. Lord.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think we'd like to have the opportunity to have our portion of the tax show up on that tax bill. We're buried right now so deep in the county's budgets, I can't find my number in there. And so we're already getting some funding from the county, and I don't think any of us are proposing to blow it out of the water and, you know, quintuple it or anything insane like that. But to be very transparent, they can see a number and they'll see soil and water conservation, whatever, on the property tax statement, and they'll know who to call. If that number ever gets ridiculous and onerous and they don't value it, they're going to know who to run against for soil and water supervisor. So we value those partnerships with the landowner so much. It's what makes our job honestly wonderful. I love going to work every day. We're not trying to become some big regulatory thing. We're really just trying to help folks do good work on the land. And we don't want to change that about us. That's why a lot of what I talked about was against the notion of this regulatory environment that's being created. I don't want to see 50 years from now 12 more regulations imposed on folks because we couldn't help them do things, you know, a little different with technical assistance and some financial assistance and sitting across that dining room table sharing a cup of coffee and having a nice conversation. That's how we work. And I don't ever want to give that up. And my colleagues throughout Soil and Water Districts, they would never want to give that up, sir.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A lot of you folks in the committee know that I'm a former watershed district manager, not a soil and water conservation district, but a watershed district manager, which did have levy authority. And in the very small area that watershed district existed, we could levy up to $230,000 a year, and we often maxed that out. And year after year, the residents of that area tried to put together petitions, tried to work with the county to roll that levy authority, at least dial it back a little. And it was an ongoing issue for almost 30 years. And I had my soil and water conservation district people in my office today, and I told them, I love you guys. These are really passionate, great people, and I hear what you're saying. I really do, and I appreciate what you're saying. But the point I made in my office today was when you have my soil and water conservation district folks come in versus other agencies, well, I tell you what, there's a difference. And I can't help but wonder if this part of the equation is the reason. And I understand Representative Purcell's desire to work on this because there's great stories out there. But I also heard at the same time that you guys are working with a $1.5 to up to $2 million budget. That's a lot of money. And that money is still continuing to come in, and the voters did work really hard to create opportunities for those revenues to come in with legacy money, with LCCMR,
And with other dollars coming in, clean water fund. And I really think that's the voters' intent, is that that money remains there as good work and opportunities are coming up. About 2 years back, we finally came to a point where my watershed district, the plug was pulled. And I guess I'm going to make two observations. Number one, when that happened, almost nobody complained. Number two, I've had literally nobody outside of my soil water conservation district come to my office and say, Josh, we just think that we absolutely have to make sure that there's more money at that level. And I'm not trying to say that as a criticism. I'm just saying, you know, the public isn't stacked in here, Representative Parcell, at least writing me emails and calling me on a regular basis. They're worried about their Second Amendment rights, and they're worried about taxes going sky high. So, you know, I'm looking at the language here, and I'm hoping that the author of the bill could tell me, you know, there's a lot of question about establishing these potential levy authorities and how that those amounts would be established. I'm assuming some kind of a referendum, and I don't see any of the dates here. They're probably right there in front of me, but maybe you could show me in the language. Would that be any time throughout the year that they could come to the voters and say, we'd put this referendum in front of you, or how would that process look? Maybe I'm missing it, but I'm assuming you have a pretty good idea.
Can you point me to the bill?
I couldn't find it in the bill. I'm sure it's right there, but I couldn't find it. Somebody's got to know where it is.
Members, if you go to the last page, it looks like there are some dates on 5.16.
So, Madam Chair, maybe someone could tell me, maybe Janelle could tell us exactly when those referendums would be established. Would that be during a normal election cycle, on election day, that the voters would weigh in on this, or would it be just any time?
Ms. Taylor. Mr. Chair, members, there's a couple of dates and where the SWCD would need to certify whether or not they're, you know, the cost and what levy amount would be, and that would be on, if you look at 2.28 and 2.29, they'd have to do that by September 15th, and then the chair already pointed out the other date on 5.16 for the charges if they use that option. And the testifiers may want to clarify, but that's what I see.
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So maybe after having that clarification, maybe the author of the bill could tell me, would this be happening, would the voters be weighing in on this during a normal election cycle, like when they go to vote for their statewide races, or when would this vote be taking place? Would it be a standalone thing, or would it be happening alongside of all kinds of other?
Chair Purcell.
Well, let me understand. I mean, there's no referendum vote on this.
So,
if that's what you're, if I'm understanding what you're asking, Representative Heisman.
Representative Heisman.
Technically, it's my point. The voters don't get an opportunity to weigh in on this. They're going to have to decide at some point who they want to elect, I guess, and if those people maybe are able to establish these dollars going forward, and maybe folks are paying attention or not, but if this was mine, I'd be looking at a way to put that in front of the voter and let them directly decide. Thank you.
Yeah, and I would just reiterate, Madam Chair, that as you know, the SWCD board members are elected. And they, you know, the voters do have that opportunity.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
He was falling asleep.
Everybody wake up.
Baby guys, anyway, I'll get some.
Representative Lewick.
It's a Mountain Dew. I've got some questions here on the funding projections. I guess, first of all, who specifically made these?
Representative Lewick, it has the MASWCD logo on the bottom.
Okay, so Let's start with the with the $27.5 million that you project that this levy's going to provide. Does that assume that the counties are going to continue at the same level of contribution or not?
I'm going to phone a friend here.
Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, Madam Chair, committee members, Sheila Vanney again, MASWCD. First, I will say that a lot of the estimates on need that are outlined in this are the product of a benchmark study that we did in cooperation with the Board of Water and Soil Resources starting in 2014 and then revised the estimates in, I believe, the winter of 2018. Second, the proposed funding image that you're looking at it's giving the SWCD options. They could continue to work status quo with their county on getting an allocation or increasing that allocation, but it does give the SWCD the authority to do the levy or the fee. Would they... in totality across the state actually fill that box to get up to the 45.3? Probably not any time in the near term, would be my guess. But it would give them the authority to flesh out their own budget, make their case to the public, and you know, go from there and be accountable for those decisions. But it isn't making any assumptions as to what might come in. It's just trying to find the authorities that could be utilized to help us get up to that $45.3 million in total need, if that answers your question, Representative Lewick.
Representative Lewick.
Well, maybe not exactly. It would appear that a big chunk of that dollars is related to what you perceive as the need. And is that how you developed a cap on the maximum levy that a particular unit could use? There's a pretty serious calculation here when you start fooling with property taxes. And I'm not sure, it isn't clear to me exactly what that this 0.48, I believe, is that based on a need, or is that based on what you believe the property tax owners will stand? Or if this alone is more complicated than the whole rest of the bill. That question.
Ms. Vanney.
Madam Chair, Representative Lewick, the 0.048% of taxable market value, I believe, is in another area of law for another local government unit. The $1 million cap, so it's not anything that we came up with ourselves based on any kinds of calculations. The $1 million cap was intended to try to hold harmless as best as we could the SWCD that is kind of the outlier in their county contribution right now. Trying to ensure that if the valve got shut off from a county allocation, that the SWCD would be able to, in fact, get that same allocation or close to it with their own authority.
Representative Lewick.
Well, and obviously the market value is the big one of the biggest determiner here, but there are a lot of counties that do $10, $11 million, $12, $14 million total for their entire budget. So, you know, you got to be very careful with that, because although there probably isn't the market value there, if there is, then you could have the local SWDC levying for $1 million. Almost 10% what a county might. Now, again, that's what I say. This is a coming up with those numbers, that's a tall order from the standpoint of really digging in and looking at how it would impact every county based on their market value, and then some comparison as to what they levy right now, because some of us remember, particularly if you sat in the county commissioner's chair, when we had levy limits on the counties, very hard. They didn't care whether you were sinking or swimming. You could not levy above that. I got some real issues with that. I guess the other thing that I'm concerned about, because I'm kind of looking at Anoka County here, and I don't want to pick on Anoka County, but do you have any idea what is the county annual levy for Anoka County?
$36 million.
Well, I can tell you, Aiken County's annual levy's almost $14 million now, and I think.
Mr. Lord.
Yeah. You know, but at any rate, I can tell you that I don't see a couple counties on here that are throwing in that kind of money, because I can tell you we levied almost what Anoka County did as a county board many years ago. So, yeah, this to me is just not the right approach. You don't set local property taxes from sitting here in St. Paul, because that's basically what we're going to do here if we move forward with this. That's because as Representative Green said, we're going to create literally another piece of local government that there's going to be a lot of county boards that are going to take one look and go, well, that's easy. You guys start paying rent to us for the building. You start paying rent to us for the use of our human services. We're not exactly going to share the vehicles anymore. That's my concern, because they're going to look and go, townships have their levy authority. There's a very bright line there, and that's my concern. I met with folks from Crow Wing County last night and again today, and one of the things I caution is be really careful what you ask for as a soil and water district, because this puts you into a situation like a township. And, you know, township supervisors are not always the most popular guys and gals in the township, because even though they don't have levy authority, the people of the township do. When they go out to do the things, you know, they're the ones that are pegged with, well, how come my township taxes went up, or how come this line went up? And that's my concern, is because I know soil and water folks do a wonderful job out there, absolutely wonderful. My concern is you're going to be looked at eventually, even though you're the field people, they're going to look at you kind of the way the county assessors are looked at when they drive in the driveway with their computer now instead of their little board, because they're kind of, look, you know, they're checking out to see if you added a new garage or anything. So anyway, to me, this is the right approach for this type of funding is go back over here and run the money down from the general fund or all these conservation funds that we are just dumping money into, and it's going to DNR gets it, MPCA gets it, Bowser gets it. It's almost like we can't seem to get it down to the right level in the right proportion to the counties, to the county level SWCCs, and the heck with the county boards. Take them out of this completely, but fund them like we do school districts. You know, put some kind of, come up with an equation. I mean, there's another way to do this. And to put this down there on the backs of the hardworking SWCC boards, who won't be as popular when they start doing levies as they are now, it just doesn't. Anyway, we got to talk about this again, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Lewick and I, just so members are understanding this local option scenario, is that each of the colors is a different way that you could do it. So it doesn't have to be based on the taxable market value. It could be based on parcels. It could be based on number of acres. It could be on number of households. Is that correct summary of what this chart? These are just options that each county could individually choose.
Madam Chair, yes. And the limit to it, just to go back to the cap on the 0.048%, is intended to you wouldn't hit the $1 million. I mean, it's whichever is less. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't hit the $1 million unless you were in a higher, relatively speaking, tax capacity county. But yes, to go back to that chart is intended to lay out options and then scenarios, just kind of playing out in a few places. Yes, it's not comprehensive, but just trying to pick out a few SWCDs in the state to show what would the impact be per fill in the blank.
Okay, thanks, Ms. Fanny. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My line of questioning is on a different kind of track. So with the exception of the seven county metro area, soil and water supervisors are elected based on land rather than population. And I think that if we do provide property, if we do provide the ability to tax property, there has to be a one person, one vote under our constitution if we're doing taxation. And so I'd like you to address the question of, and I have a follow-up question, but address how do you deal with one person, one vote if you have elected officials who are not elected based on population?
Ms. Vanny, if you want to give that a shot.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, the board members of an SWCD are in many cases geographically dispersed across the SWCD, not necessarily based on population, but in a lot of cases based on the landscape, in making sure that there are board members in touch with resource concerns in each area of the county to bring those forward to the SWCD for discussion. All of the voters in the whole SWCD vote for every one of the board members when SWCD elections are done countywide. So as far as one person, one vote, constitutionally, the way that SWCDs are set up right now, they're on solid footing. I understand that there may be desire to change to population districts if we were to move forward with levy authority, and I'm happy to have that conversation.
Representative Hansen.
I'm sure. Just to follow up, so the supervisors run by district even though they're elected countywide. So if the districts are not based on population but on geography, then that would lead to the potential that you could have an unrepresentative majority set the tax based on the population. Just to give a follow-up question, so there are 455 elected supervisors?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, there are 440 SWCD board members.
And how many of those are women?
Ms. Vanny.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I do not have that information in front of me. I could check on that and get back to you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you. I think that would be helpful. Do you have any numbers in terms of people of color or indigenous population who are elected supervisors?
Ms. Vanny.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, no, I can look into, well, I'm not sure if I will actually have that information as readily accessible. That's not information that's asked of people. I can look at names and, in some cases, maybe not all cases, make some guesses as to gender. I'm not going to be able to look at our directories of SWCD's elected officials and ascertain those kinds of pieces of information.
Thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize for the unusual position that I'm in here today. It's hard on my back, too. And let me start out by saying I recognize, you know, the really good work that the SWCDs do. I recognize the frustration that you face.
I know a lot of the SWCD people in the district that I represent, both staff and the board members, former students, and I can just run through the whole list. And so I appreciate that. And then I also applaud the really good work that the SWCD is doing. So I have a couple of questions. So there's a potential for a levy and a fee. Is it the author's intent, is it your intent that a local authority could do both of these? Or is it one, should pick one or the other? What, help me out.
Represent for yourself.
You have an answer, go ahead. I know what I want to say, but if you have something, go ahead.
Ms. Banning.
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, it is not expected that an SWCD would do more than one of the above scenarios. We actually drafted and worked with Representative Purcell on the language this way, in large part to see if there was a legislative appetite for one over the other. Because of the way that we know ad valorem property taxes are somewhat of a niche of, there are existing units of government that collect revenues that way. A soil and water management fee is, by design, more customizable to the precise work that we do, and an opportunity to incentivize conservation implementation. But it is more complicated, right? It's harder to explain, and it would probably vary from SWCD to SWCD in how they wanted to approach it. So, again, in large part, the reason that they're all there is to, anticipate, or not to anticipate, but to seek legislative input on if there is interest in one over the other. But no, I do not expect that an SWCD, even if it went forward with all of them in there, I do not expect an SWCD to use more than one.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But I don't expect that either, but I don't believe that the bill excludes that. So I think that's pretty clear to me. I sat in the office recently with an SWCD team, I'll call them, and a board member, and I flat out asked the board member, Joe, I said, do you really want the state to give you taxing authority? And kind of got that deer in the headlights look, recognizing what other members have talked about here already, of what we're facing out in rural Minnesota with regards to property taxes and so forth. And there wasn't very much of a positive response to that, almost a sense of apprehension about, I don't know. And so this is moving along. So here's another concern that I have. So of the work that SWCDs do, what percentage of that work involves some sort of a state mandate?
Ms. Vanney.
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, I would say there are... It would be hard for me to predict or to be very clear in an answer on that for you. It would depend on the SWCD and how much they've created their own kind of self-directed workload based on their own locally identified priorities. But a large part of an SWCD's work is in meeting their state obligations, delivering state programs, delivering state grants. And that is why we are asking the legislature to look at our funding needs as a shared state and local commitment. We are looking for a significant contribution from the state general fund. But, as was noted earlier, those funding discussions
You're probably fatigued by having them. I know I'm fatigued from being before you all and having these lingering unmet needs that aren't constantly before you because there isn't a clear answer. There isn't a stable, identified source of funding for SWCDs. And so, yes, we do see state obligations. Yes, we are seeking a state general fund contribution ongoing in the general fund base, but we do need local revenue to help fill that need as well.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the indulgence. The conversations that I have up in the part of the state that I represent, it's pretty lukewarm. I would say that there's a general feeling that we have a pretty good working relationship with the SWCDs, and they really, I'll make a generic statement. I don't think that this is something that's very widely supported. But what I don't want to see happen is to be able to have the legislature and the executive branch say, oh, okay, we gave them taxing authority. Now we're done with that. We don't have to worry about that. Hip to the general fund budget. If we are mandating that SWCDs do something, and I hear this too much, cities, counties, school districts, special ed, you name it, unfunded mandates. And at some point, we have to either get rid of the mandates or we have to come up with the funding. And what I don't want to see happen is to be able to just offload any responsibility through the general fund to the SWCDs and then just be able to say, well, okay, we don't need to do that because they have taxing authority locally. And I've had these passionate conversations with other people. I've sat with Executive Director Jasky and listened to his passion about trying to get funding there, and I appreciate that. I really, truly do. But in the big picture, when I take a look at what the legislature is considering this year, budget proposals and so forth, I mean, some really significant tax increases, property tax increases, gas tax, tab fees. I'm not very good at social media. I really am not. But the little bit that I do, it's unbelievable the response I'm getting from folks about just lay off. This is too much. What's going on in St. Paul this year is really just too much. And I don't want to put the SWCD in this mix this year. I respect the work that you do, and I don't want you to become, I'll say, one of the villains or whatever terms you want to use. And I don't mean that in a disparaging way in any way. I think we can do it better. I want to have a conversation with Representative Fisher and see what we can do there. That's my outlook on this. Thank you for bringing me out.
Members, as fun as it is to postulate which elected officials or government agencies are most hated or may want to be on or off that list, we do have one other bill up this evening. Are there any members of the public who would like to testify for or against this bill? Representative Green.
I just need to clarify some stuff. It'll just take me a second, and then I do have one question. According to House research, this does more than just taxing authority. It also gives the SWCDs the authority to set up soil and water management areas for the purpose of collecting revenues. That's not going to go over big. The other thing is that, just to be clear, that when counties want to levy a tax, they have to have their truth in taxation so people can come and talk about that. And as it was already stated, township officials, and there's 1,780 plus townships in Minnesota and 9,000 township officers. And if they're going to set their levy, they bring it to a vote of the people. And when the people come in for the annual meeting, the people vote on that. And it's a very open process, and this is not that process. And also in your bill, it requires notification of cities and counties, but there's nothing in here to notify the townships, which are everywhere. If you don't live in a city, you live in a township in Minnesota. Did you talk to the townships about this?
I have not personally talked to the township, Madam Chair. Representative Green.
Okay. Well, I think that I'll be talking to them tomorrow, and we'll see how they weigh in, but thank you.
All right. Any closing comments, Representative Purcell?
Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Lewis.
I would like to ask, I believe we've got some folks that represent other local units of government here, if they've got a comment on this.
Members of the public, as I offered before, if there are any members of the public who would like to testify for or against this bill, you certainly are not obligated to if that's not your desire to do so. And I guess maybe we will have this room till midnight. please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony comments.
thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Brian Martinson. I'm the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Analyst with the Association of Minnesota Counties. I believe my comments also reflect the position of Minnesota Intercounty Association. We do have concerns with the options with levy authority and fee increases that are part of this legislation. Counties value their partnerships with their local SWCDs and want to maintain that positive working relationship. There are disparities that already exist across the state, and local governments are challenged in generating enough revenue to address not only their local needs, but also to meet the obligations of state and federal requirements. Adding another local taxing authority will not improve those circumstances. We do support and encourage the state to make an ongoing contribution and to this objective. While local SWCDs do work and deliver a service on a local level in the best way for the local jurisdiction, it is for the betterment of state resources, and we encourage the state to be a more thorough player in supporting their work.
Thank you for your testimony. All right, Chair Purcell, any closing comments?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and taking a positive spin here, I thank everybody for their contributions to wanting to fund SWCDs, and it sounds like we're going to try and get it done one way or the other, and if it's not 1284, well, let's figure out what it is, but we go through this every so many sessions, and whatever we come out the other end, everybody likes SWCDs, nobody wants to fund them. So, you know, it doesn't work unless you fund them. So let's figure it out. So I appreciate all the support, and thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I request a roll call vote.
All right. Roll call being requested. Chair Purcell renews his motion that House File 1284 be referred to Ways and Means.
Purcell?
Aye.
Becker Finn?
Yes.
Lewick?
No.
Akam?
Yes.
Anderson?
No.
Bowe?
No.
Claflin?
Yes.
Fabian?
No.
Gomez?
Yes.
Green?
No.
Hansen?
Yes.
Heintzman?
No.
Lippert?
Yes.
Wagenius?
Yes.
With 8 ayes and 6 nays, the motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee.
Representative Hansen, we have House File 1292. Representative Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move House File 1292 to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Hansen, looks like maybe you have an amendment. Maybe not?
Nope.
Okay. To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm going to just literally walk right through the bill because it's very simple, and I'd have folks look at line 1.15, 1.16, 1.17, and 1.18. And this is having enhanced monetary penalties when there has been damage to property in the outdoor recreation system, which includes state parks, state recreation areas, state trails, state scientific and natural areas, state wilderness areas, state forest, state wildlife management areas, state aquatic management areas, state water access sites, state wild and scenic and recreational rivers, state historic sites, and MnDOT rest areas. So damage to adjacent property, under the current system, we're not changing how investigations or enforcement would happen relating to pesticides. We're saying that they would go through the same procedure as currently exists. But when the determination is made for a monetary penalty, and having worked in the Minnesota Department of Agriculture for many years, there is usually a series of stepped enforcement where there are letters, and then there are more letters, and there are warning letters, and then finally there may be a monetary penalty. And I want to be clear that the monetary penalty that is often available is the one that is rarely used. We'll say up to $7,500. I think the average monetary penalty is somewhere in the neighborhood of $750. So the reason for the bill is for damage to public property where people of Minnesota are using their public property. And if that damage occurs, then there's enhanced monetary penalties. So if the Department of Agriculture does an investigation and they do a letter saying don't do it again, this wouldn't apply because that would not be a monetary penalty. In addition, it says damage that they have to, so that means the department investigations would have to prove damage just like they have to prove damage before. So I think it's a fairly straightforward bill. The purpose is to protect the public resource from damage that may be occurred resulting from pesticide applications.
Representative Hansen, do you have any testifiers?
I don't know if there are. I'm assuming there are some members from the public that want to testify. There is a letter in your packet that we did receive. Maybe you want to reference that.
Yep. There is a letter in your packet from Robert Schimmick of Sugarbush Township, Minnesota. I would encourage members to take a look at that. Are there any members of the public who would like to testify for or against this bill? Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Cowan, and tonight I'm representing the Pesticide Action Network. I'll abbreviate the testimony that I have in light of the hour in respect to the committee. The Pesticide Action Network supports House File 1292. The bill is an important step in increasing accountability for those entrusted with the handling of agricultural chemicals in our rural communities. We support increased fines as a tool in the MDA's toolkit for reducing off-target damage and fostering community health for flora, fauna, and humans in these areas. A couple other points just quickly. Earlier this session in the Ag Committee, the Department of Ag gave testimony and kind of an overview of the department that, and I think the line is, in a normal year we sell about 96 million pounds of agricultural chemicals. If the population of Minnesota is 5.6 million, that's about 17 pounds a person per year. So there's a lot of chemical out there, and I think it's well worth being careful, especially in these areas, how it's applied and making sure that it's done appropriately. And to that point, I'd like to quote from the Private Pesticide Applicator Safety Education Manual, Chapter 5, Protecting the Environment Under Sensitive Sites. Pesticide applicators exercise caution at any treatment location, but certain sensitive sites require greater planning and care. As the name indicates, sensitive sites are more susceptible to negative side effects that pesticides may have. Sensitive sites include, and there's a list here, but included in the list are parks and protected natural areas. Parks and natural areas contain high-value environment resources, including threatened or endangered species. It's illegal to harm an endangered or threatened species or to destroy or modify its critical habitat when using a pesticide. And the manual tells the people applying for the license to protect people in those areas, too, by observing safe application methods. So I think the principle here is that if you're speeding in a school zone, you pay a higher fine. If you're speeding in a construction zone, you pay a higher fine. And we believe that if you're improperly using these chemicals in these areas, you should pay a higher fine. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public who would like to testify for or against this bill? Representative Hansen, any final comments?
I'm going to try to preempt the comments Madam Chair, if I can try to preempt the comments, because I think I know where they're all going to come from.
Representative Hansen.
I want to be clear that this says a person. So that is whether it's an urban person, a suburban person, a rural person. And they have to be, damage has to be proved. A person could be a rights-of-way applicator. It could be a pest control applicator. It could be a lawn care applicator. It could be a person applying a pesticide, but they have to prove that they caused damage. So no individual type of application is being picked on here. No individual is a person applies a pesticide.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to the testifier from the Pesticide Action Network, if you'd come to the table, please. You said there's 96 million pounds of pesticides applied each year, I believe you said, in the state of Minnesota.
Agricultural chemicals.
Excuse me. Okay. So that's the root of my question is you said it's agriculture chemicals. So to Chair Hansen, I would say that you may have anticipated, but you're a person testifying in favor of the bill is singling out agriculture. And I find that to be troubling. So what I would like to know is how many pounds of chemicals are applied to residentials, and what's the difference between metro versus rural?
Mr. Cowan.
Okay. It wasn't my intent to solely, even though I just cited the agricultural chemicals, it wasn't my intent just to single them out and let everybody else off the hook. If you want, I will try to find the number for non-agricultural use and provide that for you. Because certainly everybody bears a responsibility to keep these areas clean.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How many citations or whatever have been issued, penalties, for this in the past fiscal year, the past biennium? Representative Hansen.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, I do not have that information, Representative Fabian.
Representative Fabian.
Okay. So, thank you, Madam Chair. So, who investigates the claim? If there is one.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture responds.
Representative Fabian.
Madam Chair, is the Department of Ag here?
And
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, the Department of Ag is here, and this bill, the motion was to move it to Ways and Means, and it will be referred to the Agricultural Policy and Finance Division. There is a fiscal note on it, and it will be considered there. And I've already talked with Chair Poppe.
So we can't hear
Representative Fabian.
Madam Chair, we can't hear from the Department of Ag?
No, I'm just letting you know there will be continued discussion.
Please please introduce yourself, and I'll remind everybody that this is the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Committee, so if we could keep our comments and questions to things relating to that, that would be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Peter Chesset. I'm the Director of Government Affairs at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Represent Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chesset, I'm just curious to know how many of these problems have been investigated in the past year or two, and what has been the result of those investigations?
Madam Chair, representing Fabian, since 2013, there have been six cases of this nature that have six enforcement actions, I should say, since 2013 that pertain to an outdoor recreation area.
Represent Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what was the result in the penalty then? What was the resulting penalty?
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, I do not have the resulting penalty amount for each one of those six cases, but again, Representative Hansen is correct. In for a regular drift violation for a commercial applicator, first offense, it's usually around $750. But I can get back to you with specifics on those six cases.
Okay.
Represent Fabian.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. It just seems to me that, you know, this is an issue that's before us that we don't really have much of a problem, and I'm not quite exactly sure why we're doing this. But I'm sure that the Ag Committee will figure that out. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And, yeah, we'll have, I guess, comments in the Ag Committee, but I would like to disagree also with a statement made by the testifier that these lands, these state lands, should be held to a higher standard. I mean, if it hurts Mrs. Smith's petunias, I think she has just as much of a right of some recourse as you know, state park, some grass in the state park. So I don't understand why we're having different penalty enforcement amounts for a certain type of land as compared to another type of land. Again, it seems to be the camel's nose under the fence, under the tent here, and we'll talk more about this. But I just don't understand, yeah, the reason for this, Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, members, because it's all our land. That's the public's land. It's the public property that we're trying to protect. And so damages to that are damages to everyone, and that's why the enhanced penalties are what I'm proposing for that. And the reason it's here in an environment is because the state recreation areas, outdoor recreation areas, are in this jurisdiction. So I'd ask for your support.
Any additional discussion to the bill? All right. Representative Hansen, any final comments?
Ask for your support.
All right. Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 1292 be referred to Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. And with that, we are adjourned.